Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, New Books Network. This is the New Books in Journalism channel. And my name is Gordon Caddick. I'm a PhD candidate in education at the University of Toronto's Ontario Institute for Studies in Education. You may recognize my voice from the Darts and Letters podcast channel. That's how you usually hear me on the New Books Network. Well, today we wanted to share some bonus content that I thought you might like. Recently, Darts and Letters released an episode called Misinformed: The Lab Leak and the Politics of Misinformation. In that episode, I interviewed Nicole M. Krause, a PhD candidate at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Krause is a rising star in the field of science communication and the public understanding of science. In our discussion, we focused on the problems of misinformation and disinformation. 97% of journalists think that it is a serious problem today. But Krause's research complicates these ideas. She writes about a number of conceptual confusions in how we define misinformation. And she also writes about how campaigns to counter it sometimes backfire. So I decided to invite her to a conversation on the research behind mis and disinformation. We also broaden out into larger theories of science journalism and the public understanding of science. Well, Nicole Krause, welcome to the program. I'm so excited to have this conversation with you because you are such a keen observer and kind of nuanced critic, I think, of some of misinformation politics. And that's something that I have a kind of pet interest in, and your work is great. So thank you for taking the time to enlighten me with it. I was hoping to get our audience started. It is definitely the case that they know what misinformation is, at least in a kind of ambient cultural sense. What they might not know is that there's a whole sort of cottage industry of academics who study it in different ways. And to get us started, I was hoping that you could sort of explain to me what it really means. Right? Because it's obvious, it seems obvious, but maybe it's not.
What misinformation means?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So to the point you just made, there are a lot of different people who study misinformation and who have been studying it for a long time. So you could think back to, in communication contexts, research on propaganda coming out of the world wars, and some concerns then about the idea that, oh, people are kind of susceptible to false claims potentially being made by foreign actors, by domestic actors. And so in communication research, you know, there has been a long history of misinformation research that might just define it as something false. But some of this literature also says disinformation is something distinct in the sense that it would be intentionally false. The tricky thing, of course, is that things, when you start talking about anything being false, you need some kind of evidence base against which to judge the truthhood, I guess, of something. So the problem that we have is, okay, what is that evidence base in any given discipline that might be trying to define something as false? In political contexts, it can be very tricky. Sometimes we don't have access to whatever the truth might be maybe it's not something available for public disclosure. You know, it could be something classified. In science context, it may be the case that the scientific evidence base that is being used to define something as false or true is newer or older, or more or less well-established, disputed in some fields, not disputed in others. So it can become a little bit difficult to start defining what misinformation really is, although people tend to say it's something that was false at the time the claim was made.
I pulled out a quote from one of your papers that I chuckled when I read this. So you wrote, misinformation is becoming a near meaningless catch-all term for, quote, studies focused on the proliferation and impacts of false information, with many studies, including some of our own, utilizing oversimplified operationalizations. I can't ever say that word.
Me either. Glad you said it.
Operationalizations and offering no definition of, or offering no definition of misinformation whatsoever. Okay, so first of all, so much to ask about that. First of all, why? Why wouldn't they define it? But second of all, why might it be important to be precise about our definitions?
Yeah, so I did say that in that paper, because it's true that some of even my earlier research with some of my colleagues, especially in some of the work that is coming out more recently, where we're trying to identify possible solutions to misinformation. I think in some of this work in particular, there's kind of an assumption that the definition is already understood, and that, you know, we're looking at interventions at this point because we understand the problem, we understand what it is. And so there'll be a very quick assessment at the beginning of a paper that defines misinformation broadly as just something that was untrue, maybe at the time the claim was made, and then it moves quickly into the methodology of whatever this experimental design might be to kind of test whether the intervention is successful. And so I think for some of these more empirical papers, which tend to be the case for some of the assessments of what works or not and how can we fix it, the attention to the difficulty of the actual conceptualization of misinformation is kind of moved past pretty quickly. Mm. So your answer as to why, I think, I don't know if it's a failure of attention to the complexity on the part of the academic community. That would be a cynical explanation, I suppose. A more charitable one might be just that in writing a paper of this kind, this is kind of what you do.
Mm. Is it maybe just that, like, we don't want to get into an obscure philosophical argument about the nature of truth because we sort of we understand it when we see it? Sort of, you know, the old quote about pornography, like, just to be charitable. Like, is that something that someone listening to us might retort? Like, why are we becoming these sort of like pedants?
Yeah. I think absolutely. I think some of the peer reviewers I have had would suggest that to be true, where at a certain point we're not very interested in litigating what the truth is and kind of wading into these spaces. I'm not sure this is a sort of intuitive or speculation on my part, but I think there may be some concern that by adding nuance to this conversation or kind of opening ourselves to the possibility that, oh, the truth can be kind of slippery, that it's almost like giving ammunition to some kind of ambiguous enemy, whoever that might be for whoever you're talking to. So it's like, oh, if we give an inch, people will take a mile and say, oh, well, now we can think anything is true. And I don't know. That's just an intuition that I have about how maybe some people would be concerned, I guess, about saying, okay, it's difficult to define what counts as false in the context of something like COVID-19. Where there's a lot of emerging science that's changing really quickly, maybe we could say this a little bit more definitively in the context of a claim like the Earth is flat. You know, we've known that for a long time. There's a lot of evidence. There are from different types of methodologies even demonstrating that to be false. So sometimes I think there's concern maybe that if we need a kind of unified action on something, the more we're disputing about what the truth is in that context, we might get ourselves into kind of some difficulty in whatever decision-making we're trying to engage in.
It does seem like sort of some of the most important debates around misinformation, be they about the efficacy of masks or about the origins of COVID-19 or about any number of issues, are still somewhat open to contestation. I mean, some of those we may not never know, thinking particularly of the lab leak hypothesis. So it's like, yeah, this seems like a case unlike the Earth is flat, where it's just like not cut out. Like, I mean, as you kind of write in your own work, like a lot of this is fast moving and uncertain science, where it's not even the scientists are saying one thing is true or the other. It's just like a kind of judging of various probabilities based on the most up-to-date theories, right? So why call it misinformation?
Yeah, I agree. I think that we get ourselves into difficult territory defining some of these things as misinformation. And I guess when I say we, that can be a fuzzy term, because it may be members of the academic community who are doing that, but it may also be members of, you know, the media or politicians or other actors in public life who would be saying, oh, you know, this is, we don't want to spread misinformation. Incidentally, in the course of saying, we don't want to talk about this lab leak theory, we don't want to talk about, you know, the possible downsides of wearing masks. And so I guess, yeah, I think that we get into a difficult place, though, in the scientific community, if we're defining some of these things as misinformation when they are highly uncertain areas of science. And we know that it's probably going to change, or possibly going to change. And so there's I think in science communication research context, concern that there's some unfounded assumptions on the part of public actors in these situations that maybe members of the public will respond negatively to uncertainty or to a kind of fuzzier disclosure of the situation, you know, that the facts aren't so clearly defined. Maybe the scientists are still working something out or don't know certain things yet. And that doesn't really stand up well to research in our field a lot of the time, some of those assumptions. So I think people would do well to kind of check some of those intuitions about how science communication works and how members of the public do in fact respond to, you know, varying levels of certainty in scientific information.
Yeah, this is something that has really perplexed me, because I've been doing like a critical discourse analysis in my own work of some really high profile science journalists, including Ed Yong and Michael Lewis, not really a science journalist, but more a journalist of expertise and expert institutions. And one of the things, the constant refrain to your point, is that they insist that the public is incapable or uncomfortable with uncertainty. In one of Yong's pieces, he calls it the psychological loam of fear and uncertainty is what makes COVID-19 difficult to understand. And I kid you not, I see this like, you know, a dozen times in some of the writing that I've seen, and not in one case is there ever any evidence for that assertion. I don't know where it's coming from. And you're right, in the science communication literature, the evidence is like mixed at best. And it seems kind of intuitive. Like if you say to me, hey, I'm not really certain, I can't like totally answer your question, Gordon, but here's like my best bet. That engenders trust, because you're being like honest and humble. Whereas the assumption here, in some of these sort of mainstream circles, is that honesty and that humility is somehow backfires. So I don't know. Like, do you know where does that come from? That intuition.
Yeah. So I would say that, as with a lot of the intuitions in this space, I think that it's a product of oversimplification of different concepts in the model of what's happening. So, on the one hand, in this case, we have uncertainty. And there are many different types of uncertainty already. So you could say, well, how does an uncertainty disclosure of a particular kind affect audiences' perceptions of scientists, right? So it'd be like, well, what kind of uncertainty are you talking about? And that can actually make a difference, literature would suggest. Another one is the impact on the other end. So in, you know, uncertainty disclosure affects trust in science, let's say. People concerned that, oh, they'll trust us less if we don't seem to know what we're talking about. Then on that point, we have and potentially failure to recognize that trust is a multifaceted phenomenon, So trust, for example, can be composed of an assessment of a person's competence, but also their integrity. So their honesty, their kind of adherence to particular kinds of norms, for example, of their profession, but also benevolence. Are they a well-intended person who seems to want the best for society, for people other than just themselves? So one of the things that can happen is uncertainty disclosures might, of certain types of them, for example, mm-hmm. might maybe make, in some cases, scientists seem less competent. So let's say the uncertainty was the result of some kind of methodological error, these findings for this study, but they're beset by X, Y, Z uncertainty because of these errors the scientists made in data collection. So, okay, well, now maybe you take a hit, I suppose I would say, to some perceptions of competence, like a little bit, but you get gains in integrity, maybe, because you were willing to disclose it. So to your point, there's like, it's mixed at best, that these different kinds of uncertainty disclosures are responded to by members of the public and different subdimensions of trust, maybe. And in the end, aggregate trust might actually stay the same or go up because the competence hit was small enough. And as a final point, I guess I would say that if you have to err on the side of like, should I disclose or not? I would say that scientists are also already seen as very highly competent as a group of people. So the competence dimension is not necessarily the one I think that scientists need to be concerned about. They should be a little more concerned about the perceptions of their integrity or their warmth or their benevolence, which some subsets of the population, wouldn't necessarily ascribe some of those traits to scientists. So if we can get gains through uncertainty disclosure, through humility, through the recognition that we're not really sure we should call this misinformation yet, for example, in some of those subdimensions of trust, it would make sense to me to disclose, even if there's a little bit of a decline in competence perception.
Makes sense. So on the misinformation front, we've talked a little bit about sort of kind of getting it wrong, I guess. So when we're talking about what is and is not information, misinformation in a fast moving context where there's uncertainty around the evidence. What about it sort of on the political front? Like what is, like, this is where I feel kind of my back, I get my back up about misinformation because it sort of seems to reinscribe a kind of epistemic hierarchy and authority in the role of the scientist, and not even necessarily just the scientist, but like the most elite sort of scientific policymakers. But what's your thought on that? Like, are there political dangers to kind of this frame?
The misinformation frame? Mm-hmm. I think so. There are some kinds of claims. Again, with this point, like not all misinformation is created equal. I think that is a big takeaway, I suppose, for anyone listening, is that we would be well served to recognize that because we could have more precise conversations then. But the frame of misinformation for certain kinds of claims that have not just something like scientific uncertainty associated with them, as is the case for COVID and any claims we might make about it, but also geopolitical uncertainty, for example, in the case of the lab leak claim, we may never have the data that we need to answer that question. For not necessarily for reasons of science, but because of politics. And so I think wading into certain kinds of spaces where the claims, the evidence base has uncertainty associated with it of multiple intersecting types, scientific, political, that is an especially messy area. And it's already messy enough, even when the claims seem fairly clear cut. So I think that there are risks associated with that. I also think that when scientists present themselves publicly as aligned with particular political positions or political actors, there's always this risk of the politicization of science, which can exacerbate polarization problems surrounding science. And for that reason, I think it is worth including in the risk-benefit calculus of correcting misinformation or defining things as misinformation, whether the possible political fallout is really worth it, you know, right. if people continue to hold this false belief, what are we talking about as a possible risk? Depends what it is. You know, again, it's not all the same. People thinking the earth is flat maybe aren't going to be in physical harm compared to thinking hydroxychloroquine is safe, or that they should drink, or not drink, take ivermectin, whatever right. it's called. So, you know, but for each of these cases, it's kind of, you'd pile up the risks on one side, health risks, public health consequences, for example. There might be political consequences if you attempt to correct. And then there are a lot of unknowns for the risk and benefits in both cases. So mm-hmm.
I also think that a lot of times things that are pitched as debates about scientific facts are only partly so, because, I mean, first mm-hmm. of all, we know that science is sort of value laden and political, like from top to bottom. And I don't think that's necessarily a problem. But even when people are talking about like lockdowns, like they may be adjudicating purported mm-hmm. scientific facts that they get right or they get wrong, but they're also making claims about what kind of world they want to live in, what sort of popular sovereignty they desire, what kind of political ideology they have. Maybe they're like, you know, far right libertarians. Maybe they have some sort of like religious conviction for one reason or another. Anyways, all I'm saying here is that it seems like not enough to say, okay, you got the fact wrong, because actually what the most important thing is in this debate over the facts is what they mean, how to interpret them, where to take them, and what kind of society that we want to live in. That's my yeah. big worry about misinformation, because it sort of like, it attempts to shut down that conversation a lot of the times.
Yeah, there's a great piece in Science, I think it was in Science, called "Was Science on the Ballot?" It was Sheila Jasanoff and some other colleagues. And in that commentary piece, I suppose, there was a line that I really love, because it mentioned that some of these battles over the facts are actually just proxy battles for disagreements yeah. about competing ways of life and value systems. And really, I think they phrased it as a kind of dissatisfaction on the part of some audiences with what they see as the elevation of science values, or values that scientists and experts might hold over their own priorities mm-hmm. and competing interests. And so I think that came up a lot in the context of COVID-19. I mean, the provision of particular kinds of information in service of recommendations, that the facts at hand would be public health facts, right? We could also be providing data about the possible economic consequences of lockdown as well, in service of a different kind of value priority. But so I think some of the time there's a particular set of concerns established, mm-hmm. and then facts are rendered or provided as argumentation for particular versions of life that we might want, kind of response strategies that we might want. And it's not that the facts are true, or, you know, I'm not disputing whether the facts given in those cases are false, but the idea is that I think some people see this and think, well, we could talk about many other kinds of things. And so they mm-hmm. dispute the facts at hand, even if they're not saying like those facts aren't true, but like why those and not some of the other ways that we could talk about this, again, in an entirely accurate, truthful way, but from a totally different angle as driven by value systems or policy preferences, mm-hmm. things like that.
And then we might even have a real chance of like making the case, right? We might even say, actually, yeah, we actually want more public health, but here's why, not because you are misinformed. I wanted to ask you a kind of stupid question. And it's simply like, why do we even... We have other words, right? We have lies, we have inaccuracies, we have misleading claims. To your earlier point, we have propaganda. So what is mm-hmm. what is misinformation? What does it do for us that's different from some of these other words that seem to me more plain spoken, more colloquial, and more easy to understand for basically everyone?
Yeah, that's a good question, because I think in some of the literature about misinformation, sometimes there are distinctions that people attempt to make. Like there are subsets of research about rumor, for example, mm-hmm. and, you know, rumor kind of has a different epistemic state, really, than misinformation. In some cases, like, it's ambiguously false, you know, something that maybe has a certain kind of intention associated with it, possibly, or it has a highly social quality in spreading, I guess, in the way that it does. So misinformation, I think, maybe is a term that we've been using a lot, in part because it's so broad. It's my first thought in response to what you're saying, is that it catches so much. See the quote that you read from me, I suppose. It catches so much that we could just kind of connect what we're talking about to so many other literatures, to so many policy contexts, to so many funding opportunities. I don't want to sound so cynical as to think that's why, you know, members of the academic community use it, but I think the idea is that there's certain words that, like, once we all kind of agree, it makes it easier to talk about and to recognize each other as participating in a shared conversation, having established this shared language. But yeah, it's almost like it becomes branding, which I hesitate to say, but yeah, I don't know, we could call it other things. So as you asked that, I guess I didn't have an immediate answer except for the convenience, I suppose, of just calling it misinformation so we can all communicate. But there's always something lost in that continued oversimplification and broadening of a word. It could be more nuanced.
It feels like the word that, like, an information scientist uses, whereas like bullshit is a word that, you know, I might use, or the public might use.
Some people do. There's a little, there's a body of literature about bullshit receptivity as a trait. And then, yeah, I think, yeah, we could use very, very different words, but you're right. It does have a kind of, maybe it sounds more technical almost, and in that way, more credible or something. I'm not sure.
My name is Gordon Caddick, and you're listening to New Books in Journalism. This is an extended bonus interview that came out as part of the podcast Darts and Letters. If you like what you hear, consider subscribing to that podcast. Darts and Letters covers the politics of academia, expertise, and intellectual life. You can find our work at dartsandletters.ca or here on the New Books Network. Just go to the website and go under the Academic Partners tab, and you'll see it there. Okay, let's set aside the kind of like epistemic questions about what is and is not information and misinformation. And let's stipulate that there is such a thing that exists and we see someone spreading it. What are some of the prevailing theories as to what motivates someone to be receptive to it and then to promulgate it themselves?
Okay. So I think one of the ways to think about what we know about why people might be susceptible to misinformation, if you want to say susceptible, is to think about individual level, social level, and structural level explanations. So individual level ones being aspects of their psychology, which can be things like their personality traits, which would be more intrinsic and innate to who they are. I think maybe some people are highly dogmatic, for example, or some people say certain people are more prone to magical thinking, for example, and that some of these traits might make it more likely that they would not be interested in accepting claims about the world, including facts that contradict what they already believe, or that contradict that thinking style. So that's like an intrinsic explanation, where it's, okay, some people are systematically more likely to reject facts of particular kinds, maybe rendered from science. Others are saying, well, you know, psychologically, everybody has a tendency, in, depending on the context, to engage in this kind of biased processing of information, motivated reasoning, sometimes we hear it called. And we'll say, you know, if the issue climate and the way that elite members of society have been talking about something like climate change is such that you, as a member of the conservative political parties or Republicans, need to kind of align with your group by saying, you know what, they're talking about it that way, so I should just conform, I suppose, and believe what they are believing so I can stay a good member of my group. That's kind of like an identity protective motivation that people might have, and could be kind of social psychological. And it could change depending on the context. You know, if your group is talking about something a particular way, you could see how that could manifest differently based on a bunch of different factors. But other explanations are less about individuals and more about systemic realities or sometimes failings. As an example here, there's, people talk about realities of our information ecosystem. So you'll hear things like everything I said about social psychology intersecting very poorly with the reality of how media algorithms are designed to kind of incentivize us to share or spread really outrageous, emotive, kind of evocative content among the same groups of people that already agree with us. So those are structural explanations. An interesting one I heard recently was from Carol Graham. I think she's at Brookings, and she points to the, in her data, that individuals who are more susceptible to misinformation tend to also be located in areas of the country that have higher indicators of low well-being, which she calls them deaths of despair, opioid use, suicide. And in her argument, she's saying like, well, this point about information ecosystems is probably part of the explanation, but doesn't explain why we would have systematically different uptake of misinformation in counties of the country that are exceptionally low in well-being in these metrics. And so her argument is like, we could see an explanation for the why of misinformation is kind of lack of hope about their future, their lives. And we know already in other kinds of outcomes that individuals experiencing that kind of despair will engage in radical behaviors, risk-taking behaviors, drugs. In her argument, she's saying, well, radical beliefs are similar outcome of that situation. And therefore, we could improve the well-being of people across the country in some of these areas if we wanted to fight misinformation, which is a very different explanation than saying, okay, there's something wrong with their individual level psychology. They're just innately magical thinkers. And that's, you can see kind of how these explanations end up. They could be many of these things at the same time at different levels of analysis, individual, structural kind of intersections between them. But there are many theories at these different levels.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And it could be all of those forces all at once in different contexts for different types of people, which makes it complicated.
Exactly.
But I find that that last case on the deaths of despair, I don't know the research at all there, but it sounds compelling to me because I have often saw misinformation and like distrust of scientific authority as almost like collateral damage of a political order that many people see rightly as not serving them. So it's kind of like resentment, anger, mistrust, conspiracy is just kind of like downstream from, you know, alienation, dislocation, deprivation, and all the things that make one kind of like rightfully pissed off. So to the extent that we can like improve those conditions rather than shame the people who are resentful, that feels more productive to me.
Yes, I agree with you. I agree. And I think what's interesting in some of this research is that when, you know, there are resentments or frustrations, there could be a disconnect between what an individual perceives to be the case about their own disadvantage and the objective assessments of their disadvantage. So some of this literature will say things like, oh, you know, you see a lot of these resentments or grievances on the part of particular subsets of the population, and where we see those grievances, maybe that's where we also see misinformation uptake or what some people describe as anti-science behavior. And then there will be like, well, are their grievances justified, right? Do they hold up to the state of the resources that are flooding into their community or not? You know, if members of rural communities think, oh, they don't get their fair share or something, is that really the case based on, you know, some of the allocation of funding or services? You know, is that true? So one thing I think is interesting too is that sometimes the intervention is we might need to improve well-being legitimately. We might also need to improve the perception on the part of some of these individuals that there is, there's a community of people in power, maybe who don't care. And it's like, maybe again, a proxy battle, I guess is all I'm saying, that even some of the grievances might be perceived and are really ways of expressing dissatisfaction with not being seen or with a lack of dignity or respect or other things, even if they don't actually translate to to what might be called a true dearth of resources. And well, I don't know if that's making sense, but
I see what you're saying. But it feels hard to me to do that because, like, people don't judge their own well-being upon some like absolute standard.
Exactly. Yeah.
And say, oh, okay, I'm actually like I'm fourth place, and fourth place isn't so bad because sixth place has it worse. It's like it's much more relative to your own context, to your own life expectations, to what's been told to you. You know, that sort of like those histories that you have, and maybe you do have like a kind of unjustified entitlement to an American dream that's been kept from other people, and you're feeling the sting for the first time. But that doesn't mean the sting is illegitimate. You know, it still is felt.
The reason I mention it is partly because I think that it adds another approach to something we might do. So in addition to actually improving the well-being, the other thing would be that if the sting is still felt, just as you say, because in part because of just subjective assessment, like you're assessing it based on where you've positioned and what expectations maybe that have been based on your own experience in life, you know, and there's nothing to dismiss that perception would, I think, be kind of absurd. But also I think that we can add to the possible suite of solutions that, well, if the perception is, I guess, what someone might say off by some objective standard, or there's some hierarchy there, that there's the perception still exists potentially because of other things that we are doing communicatively or socially or culturally to whether that person's, I guess, objective empirical reality supports the idea that they should feel resentment. They still do. So where is that coming from? It could in part be, you know, offensive, kind of gratuitously dismissive communications from individuals. It could be telling people that, you know, basically implying that they're stupid or that they don't understand things or that they should just listen and kind of stay in line. And that those kinds of things, I think, can add to that perception as well. So then it kind of, I mention it because it opens an avenue to me where some of the interventions then become things like humility on the part of people in power or symbolic communications, recognizing that whether you think these people should feel dismissed or disregarded or resentment based on the resources they receive, maybe they do in part because they're not feeling seen. I don't know.
I wanted to ask you about another academic term I don't understand, and it's infodemiology, the infodemic and inoculation theory. It's just like growing body of scholars who are studying misinformation and disinformation as if it is like a viral disease that is spreading, which strikes me just on the face of it as puzzling, because diseases in some sense exist in the world, mind independent of our judgments of them, and they produce harm. Whereas misinformation is, you know, through our own respective agency, and we can decide whether or not to accept it and to spread it and what it means to us. So it seems strange to talk about information as like a pathogen. But yeah, you've written on the, you know, the so-called infodemic. Yeah, what is this, and briefly, what is your work in this area been?
Yeah, so infodemiology, the infodemic was something the World Health Organization said about the information environment surrounding COVID-19. So that's at least the first time I was exposed to the word infodemic and infodemiology. Whether it existed prior to the World Health Organization saying that, I don't actually know. But the idea is that in addition to the virus that we were battling during the pandemic, there's the information climate, which is beset to some extent by false claims. But even when the World Health Organization said it, they weren't necessarily referring just to falsehoods. They're just like, there's a lot of information out there. It's just like a deluge of information. And so infodemiology seems to, yes, take this kind of medical analogy and say, well, if we're trying to understand the spread of misinformation, we could treat it like a virus and kind of look at some of the movement of this claim through bodies, information bodies, in the sense of like, maybe you could conduct network analyses of like, how is this claim seem to be moving through social media, for example. It originated here, and then it managed to move from that node in the network all the way out to these kind of peripheral, smaller nodes far away. And so to some extent, I guess I would say there's some of the research where it's like tracking it almost like an object that would spread the same way you would track traces of the virus, presence of the virus, viral DNA in whatever. And I suppose for some of that work, that sort of makes, I guess, some sense to me. If you could think that you want to model the spread of that claim, I don't know how a lot of that research works, to be honest, but I think that there's some logic to it. Where the analogy gets troubling for me is when it's understood to affect an individual body or individual mind the same way a disease would affect someone. So because I think we get very much into the space of pathologizing humans, like people, for the things they believe, which I think is a dangerous place to be. If we want to treat information claims as something that's spreading through particular media infrastructures like virus so that we could trace how they're moving, I suppose maybe that makes some sense. You know, I would have to think about it more, but I think we get into a weird space when we start saying like, oh, people are infected if they believe particular kinds of things, in part because of almost like, if we want to keep the medical analogy, now we stigmatize people for having what appear to be these illnesses of the mind, which I think will lead to social consequences. And not to mention that it kind of elides the reality of everything I just said about how some of these things have more to do with structural and social realities in some cases, potentially, than just individuals failing to protect themselves from misinformation.
Yeah, I mean, I've read a little bit about this research. I don't know a ton about it, but, you know, the sort of statements on what the research priorities are of the infodemic, some of them seem reasonable. It's like you were saying, like, can we track kind of information, where it's going? It seems like a worthwhile thing to like know what people are talking about. But then like, what is the upshot of that sort of like scouting? And at least all of the public facing resources are like, you know, they're very individualized. They're like, you know, think through your information and like, don't read too much news. It'll overwhelm you. Or like, you know, consider trustworthy sources. It's basically all sort of like old information diet sort of stuff. And none of it, like, it seems like none of it is attending to the broader social context that you were just talking about. So it's like re-inscribing this sort of individualized way of understanding information, which is too bad.
Yeah, I agree.
But that leads me to one of the kind of themes I wanted to end on, and it regards sort of like, yes, the public pathology thing that you mentioned, I think is such a good point. I wanted to get people who haven't studied science communication, they probably don't know that there are these like different models, right, of like how we think about the public and how we think about the nature of science communication. And one of them, one of those sort of long held sort of hobby horses of any sort of critical scholar in science communication is to say, don't think about it as like a knowledge deficit or a public deficit. So in other words, it's not that you have an uneducated public that you kind of open up their head and then you put facts into it and then you are somehow addressing that deficit and therefore now they trust and understand science. There's this sort of shift towards kind of more democratically minded science communication that involves kind of dialogue and things like that. But I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that, like just in more particular detail, like what is the knowledge or public deficit? And in your own work, are you seeing that it's still there? Is it something different? Where are we at now with sort of prevailing modes of science communication?
Yeah, I think you summarized the deficit model pretty well with the opening of the person's brain and putting the facts in, because that's kind of the idea that, okay, if we see members of the public exhibiting attitudes and beliefs that really aren't well aligned with members of the scientific community, this is an old question, you know, not just since, for example, people saying climate change is not human caused, but we had problems like this for a long time. When we put fluoride in water, for example, people concerned about that and forming opinions that maybe didn't reflect what scientists were saying. So old question, and an answer tends to be like, oh, we'll just give people the facts. And if they knew the things scientists knew, they would agree with scientists. Like as if the outcome that a scientist's opinion is just kind of a natural consequence of reasoning, that if you just put it in this, you put the facts in, you would automatically run through the function and you would get the output, which I think is an oversimplification of how individuals form their opinions, but also an oversimplification of how scientists form their opinions as people too. So in any event, that model is old. It's one that a lot of research in science communication as an interdisciplinary area has shown is not necessarily accurate. There are some cases where it's like, yes, the provision of facts can influence the attitudes people form in science contexts, but typically people's opinions tend to be informed more by other things like their value systems, their risk perceptions, for example. But as that model of public opinion of science has been challenged, people have kind of been proposing other ones. And the disturbing thing to your question about whether it continues to appear is that it does. This deficit model just kind of transforms. Some of my colleagues at UW-Madison have referred to it as kind of the zombie of science communication, because it just keeps coming back in these different forms. But an example being, you know, we moved from saying that members of the public just need more facts to saying now we have a trust deficit. The problem with the public is now this. It's that they don't trust scientists enough as producers of facts. So there's challenges to the legitimacy of their epistemology. And then from there, it's like, well, okay, they don't have they have facts. They just have the wrong ones. They have alternative facts or inaccurate facts. And this is where we see these discussions of misinformation. I would put those conversations there where, well, if we are concerned that the American public, for example, is split on something like mask wearing, then a quick response to be like, well, what is going on with public opinion of science? To be like, well, they have the wrong facts. There's a deficit of some kind with members of the public. In all of these cases, the assignment of the problem is in the public. It's the thing with all of these models of the deficits, like whatever the deficit is, they all share their locus, I guess, in people's minds. And that is a continued frustration of science communication researchers and researchers in science and technology studies, other fields, who would say that there are other problems, possibly more important ones, that have to do with institutional realities. Incentive structures within science itself, communication by members of the scientific community or their representatives, systemic failings like the one I was just talking about, where some of these problems may have more to do with well-being or But the discussion of public deficits ends up at putting us in this place of putting so much accountability on individual people for the beliefs that they form.
It's a funny concept for me, and it's funny how the field has kind of metabolized the critique or hasn't, because, you know, just recently the top journal in the field had this like 30-year retrospective, and all the editors came back and they said, you know, in our very first issue we were critiquing the public deficit model, and we have since, and it's this kind of like you know, this you flog this dead horse constantly, like it is, we're past this, and yet they also all, to your point, say actually we're not. Like it keeps reemerging, and why? Like if everyone seems to like it's not. I mean, I'm sure there's some debate. There is some debate, but it's pretty common to see people flog this dead horse, yet it keeps coming back. So what is it that makes it so so appealing?
Yeah, I think a few things come to mind. One is that I think it's intuitive for a lot of people who maybe don't study public opinion or communication generally. I think there's a lot of increasing interest at the moment in allocating resources to understanding misinformation problem, for example, problems. And there are people from many different scientific disciplines who are interested in doing this, maybe with less training in some of these areas. So for them, the deficit model maybe not even be something they're familiar with in some cases. And it's kind of they're a foray from economics, for example, or it's political science into the question of why don't people believe what scientists have to say. And they kind of start where science communication researchers started with this deficit model all over again. And so some of it might just be academic siloing, I guess is what I am saying. I think another answer is that there are, it's easier to make external attributions of blame for things like psychologically than it is for self-reflection. So that might be part of it. It's just that, you know, if we ask what's wrong, it's maybe not a natural thing to immediately say, well, maybe there's something wrong with us, like on the production side of communications here. And this is a supply side problem. It's maybe easier to just say that there's something wrong with the people buying our product, you know? And that could be, I think a third answer is that it's feels, whether it's true, maybe easier to more manageable of a problem to focus on individuals and their minds. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if the truth is to some extent that there are institutional problems in science, in government, if there are problems with our information ecosystem, the way we regulate it or don't, the design, the economics that underlies how we provide information to people, I think those are huge questions of intersecting, interconnected systemic problems, where it becomes like, where would we even begin to pull the levers? And some of those systems end up being highly complicated. So it's also maybe difficult to anticipate what would happen if we were to change something in the hope of fixing, for example, the misinformation problem. Then is it just kind of whack-a-mole with some of those systemic dials? So I think individual change feels easier, maybe, where it's like a low-hanging fruit to say, well, why don't we just try to arm people against susceptibility to misinformation rather than fix some of the systems and infrastructures that are putting this problem into the world in the first place. That's kind of, I guess, the tour of some of my thoughts.
That makes sense. Yeah, one thought I had was like in regards to how deficits have evolved in the context of misinformation and conspiracy and, you know, in the way that we are infected by it. It seems to me different I mean, it's an evolution, but it seems quite different because I always read, I mean, correct me if I'm misreading it, but I always read public deficit as a kind of naive modernism. Do you know what I mean? Where it's just like, you know, scientists can produce objective knowledge and then educate the educable through their effective communication. And then therefore, mm-hmm. we will all be modernists. Whereas the kind of much more jaundiced view of public reason, as public as infected, it's a deficit of a sort, but it's almost more of a defect, where it's like much more of a willingness on the part of sort of technocratic and scientific authorities to say, you know, this project of educating them didn't work out so well. Now what we need to do is like surveil and discipline and ensure that they're protected because their brains are broken because we can't teach them anymore. So in a way, it's still a deficit, but it's a much deeper deficit almost.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a kind of paternalism to it that's like, well, we know best. And you mentioned earlier the idea of inoculation, for example, as an intervention strategy for misinformation. So I think this, while individuals maybe are not behaving is a strong word, you know, not necessarily processing information the way that we would hope in terms of accuracy. And so we can kind of expose publics to this deception strategy that they might see and then say, okay, well, if you see this, now you know how to reject it. And we're kind of arming people with this ability to kind of prevent the uptake of misinformation in the first place, which could potentially limit public discourse. And kind of by arming people in this way. But the idea there, I think, is that, okay, well, we need to give people something because it's like you say, there's almost like a defectiveness to the way they think about things. And that needs to be corrected to ensure that we kind of constrain the conversation to the things that as experts, we have kind of deemed within the acceptable scope of public discourse, essentially. That is concerning in part because of what you said about, you know, technocratic kinds of perspectives where, you know, we democratically would hope that there, you know, the scope of discussions we're having about science are informed by much more than what kind of experts have deemed acceptable claims. I don't know. I've lost track of what you said originally, but I think I'm saying that I share your concern about this being naive, especially because of all of the things that we have been learning for decades and is becoming there's some increasing attention to it now, I guess, with some of the diversity initiatives in science, for example. But the scope of the claims that the expert community have managed to produce is kind of limited by the people who've been participating in it. And that can include classes of people. So I think we talk a lot about particular ethnicities or racial groups or women, you know, having been excluded from scientific production and kind of this body of knowledge that we're using to potentially constrain acceptable claims. But there's also a certain class of people. There's like a total decline of first generation college students and PhD holders, for example. Mm-hmm. And so I think, this reality is that there's a lot of people from particular classes of society occupying these positions in expert areas that are now being used to potentially inoculate members of the public. That concerns me. It's like, we should be worried about that, I think. But
absolutely. Well, Nicole Kress, this has been a fantastic and really enlightening conversation. Thank you so much for your time.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.